بشرى لأرض نزلتم في نواحيها كأنكم ماطر أحيا سواقيها ترنو لكم كلما لح المصيف لها حبا لنور الهدى والشوق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته وعن ونكسان دغستيال ملك استو أدجوكتان يسيولي بو أدنو مقليسان كسو دوادا برامشكا عالم اليوم ومالين مخميسا هو اي تاريخ دو كوبيغان تهي لبي تومنك شوال سنة دا كون أفر بقول أفرتاني لحجري مانتا برامشكا عالم اليوم قبيهان تسبا وحان كسو قادن دونا حلقة دي كوباد دوكومينتري غلوغو مقع دري لغراها بانجيغا أدونكا اي هيادا IMF ay muassasada Al-Kataib ka soo saartay dhaqaalaha Soomaaliya ku soo dhawaada nuskhadiisa Ingiliishka.
Bismillaahir Rahmaanir Rahiim.
For decades, the International Monetary Fund or IMF and the World Bank have carefully crafted an image of themselves as saviors of the global economy. They've often presented themselves as champions of economic development who work tirelessly towards achieving sustainable economic growth and reducing poverty around the world. Far from being the altruistic heroes they claim to be, however, these financial institutions act as master puppeteers, skillfully pulling the strings of the global economy behind the scenes and forcing nations into accepting punishing economic reforms under the guise of assistance. What they label as aid is in reality nothing more than a tool of control and subjugation, a means to impose their will on the world's most vulnerable, all while maintaining an aura of virtue.
IMF and World Bank are economic enslavers. What they are designed to do is to ensure that we are in a perpetual state of debt.
I think the most evil organizations in the world today are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund.
The World Bank, Banco Mundial, and IMF, they are not serious people. They just support consumption. I have a governor here. Is the governor of the bank, is here. IMF gives him money called import support. Can you imagine? They give him money to import, to support imports. And that's a debt to my people. Support imports, not of capital goods, but of perfumes. What do you call these other dead people's hair, alcohol, wine? Okay, I wouldn't mind if those who want to buy alcohol, but if they could give me fast money for investment, and that the other one was additional. So this is off the point.
Despite presenting themselves as experts in economic policy and development, the IMF and the World Bank are merely extensions of the Western colonial legacy, perpetuating the same patterns of control and exploitation in developing countries, this time on the economic front.
Tell me, how many countries have actually succeeded since the creation of the IMF and the World Bank in moving decisively from developing country status to industrialized nation status? The result has been that developing countries have consistently been suppressed in their economic development, and their resources have been extracted very efficiently and very cheaply for the benefit of the industrialized countries. So essentially, it's a continuation of the colonial relationships on an economic front. This is what the IMF and the World Bank have been overseeing in the last, 70 years or so.
In December 2023, the apostate government of Somalia celebrated what it called a historic triumph, the completion of the IMF's so-called debt relief program under the Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, or HIPC. Apostate government officials claimed to have achieved a monumental feat, convincing the Somali people that their country was now debt-free. The reality, however, was starkly different. Somalia was still mired in IMF's classic debt trap, with over $700 million in outstanding debt as of December 2023. In this documentary series, we will uncover the truth behind the highly touted $4.5 billion debt relief that Somalia allegedly received. Far from being a genuine relief effort, this so-called forgiveness was nothing more than a cynical trade-off. By entering the HIPC initiative, the apostate government effectively agreed to pursue an economic policy that had to be approved in Washington. In doing so, Somalia surrendered its economic sovereignty to the IMF and World Bank, with the $4.5 billion merely serving as the price tag. This was not an act of altruism, but a calculated sale of national economic control for a measly price. This series will uncover the story of how the apostate Somali leaders colluded with international financial institutions to impose harmful economic policies on the people of Somalia, all while portraying themselves as benevolent saviors. It's a tale of deception orchestrated by the IMF and World Bank in partnership with weak and ineffective leaders who concealed their betrayal behind a mask of patriotism.
وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ لَا تُفْسِدُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ قَالُوا إِنَّمَا نَحْنُ مُصْلِحُونَ أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ هُمُ الْمُفْسِدُونَ وَلَكِنْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ.
In 1944, towards the end of World War II, 730 delegates from 44 nations converged in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, for what came to be known as the Bretton Woods Conference. There, they established the IMF, or International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, with the purported aim of promoting global economic stability and financing the reconstruction of European nations devastated by the war. The IMF was designed to oversee international monetary cooperation and provide short-term financial assistance to countries, while the World Bank aimed to provide long-term loans for reconstruction and development projects. By the 1980s, US President Ronald Reagan and British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher strongly promoted a set of economic policies known as neoliberalism. These policies were presented as sophisticated solutions for enhancing global economic growth and stability. In practice, however, they primarily served the interests of wealthy Western economies while often harming developing nations. As direct colonialism gradually faded, Western powers realized that they could still maintain control and extract economic benefits from their former colonies through a new mechanism, debt. To access loans, however, former colonies were required to implement what is known as the Washington Consensus. These were a series of the neoliberal policies that overwhelmingly favored Western interests and corporations. The IMF and the World Bank became the key instruments for imposing these policies worldwide, exploiting the economic vulnerability of poor countries. This effectively positioned the IMF as a tool of U.S. influence, given the significant role the U.S. Treasury plays in shaping its policies.
This idea on paper became captured by the U.S. and Western Europe, right? It became geopoliticized. These two entities became tools of projecting Western power, and that's why it's no surprise that the IMF is headquartered in Washington, D.C., the World Bank is headquartered in Washington, D.C., the president of the World Bank is effectively picked by the president of the U.S., and the managing director of the IMF is effectively picked by Europeans, right? So one has to understand this. And because of this, and because there's this, you know, the West wants to maintain dominance, you know, economic dominance, it's useful for capitalism, for example, to have subservient countries to provide the raw materials that powers the engines in the center, in the core, in the metropole.
The IMF is not an independent or humanitarian organization. The IMF is an arm of the American government. Indeed, the IMF is a formidably potent weapon of America, which it has employed for many decades now in all four corners of the world. In short, if a country is a member of the IMF and receives loans from the IMF, then this enables the American government to have a say in the internal affairs of that country, presents the Americans with leverage which they relish the opportunity to use over a country which pursues an independent foreign policy and which Washington is very much eager to see overturned, so that the foreign policy of this country, the independent foreign policy of this country, is replaced by a foreign policy which is pro-Western.
Think about who runs the IMF. Who makes the decisions? Well, there are two problems. One of them is the voting rights are disproportionately in the hands of the advanced industrial countries. There's been a lot of complaints about the UN with only five countries having the veto power. In the IMF, only one country has the veto power. As you know, there's a meeting beginning in Canada called the G8 or G7. Well, it's the G1 that has the veto power in the IMF.
By controlling these institutions, the United States and her allies, the former European colonial masters, discovered they could get much of what they wanted in more subtle ways. They no longer needed armies and weapons to exploit the wealth and resources of other nations. All they needed were clever bankers, gullible or corrupt domestic officials, and an international financial regime led by the IMF and the World Bank, which acted as the collection agency for the lenders. The IMF and World Bank thus became the main instruments of economic imperialism and the driving force behind the new exploitation.
The IMF and the World Bank are basically Western institutions which were created soon after the war in order to be able to provide what you might call an economic platform for development of the war-ravaged countries in Europe at that time. So you may notice that it's not strictly a purely pro-Africa kind of organization. If anything, a lot of observers see it as an institution that preys on Africa rather than support Africa.
IMF and World Bank are economic enslavers. What they are designed to do is to ensure that we are in a perpetual state of debt. You can never get out of IMF and Bretton Woods institutions generally, because they want to ensure that they control your economy. And when they control your economy, they control your politics. And when they control your politics, they control you. And when they control you, they bring in military bases. And when they bring in military bases, they determine who governs you, because if you don't play ball, they are going to instigate the armies to overthrow you.
Tell me, how many countries have actually succeeded since the creation of the IMF and the World Bank in moving decisively from developing country status to industrialized nation status?
When the IMF are looking at countries that have developed, why have they deployed these policies? Is it because they haven't got the knowledge to understand how to really go about rebooting these economies?
I think that hypothesis is not tenable. There's no empirical evidence for that.
Right.
The designers of those policy recommendations for developing countries are very smart people. They do understand key concepts and key realities.
So who are they serving?
Well, you just need to look at the result. The result has been that developing countries have consistently been suppressed in their economic development, and their resources have been extracted very efficiently and very cheaply for the benefit of the industrialized countries. So essentially, it's a continuation of the colonial relationships on an economic front. This is what the IMF and the World Bank have been overseeing in the last, you know, 70 years or so.
There are five phases that define the historical relationship between Muslims and the West. The first phase is termed the phase of violence and crushing of bones, characterized by the use of brute force, massacres, and destruction inflicted upon Muslims. This was the period when disbelievers invaded Muslim lands and subjugated the Muslims under their colonial empire. After the defeat of Muslims, the second phase began, known as the phase of partitioning. Previously, the Muslim world was unified, with mutual support across regions. However, it was fragmented into smaller states with artificial boundaries imposed and new names created to divide them. These divisions ensured that each group was restricted to its designated area, losing their shared identity and unity. The third phase that emerged is described as the phase of Westernization. This involved altering the beliefs, ideologies, and cultural values of Muslim societies. Education systems, economic models, political frameworks, and the social fabric were all reshaped to align with Western ideals. A new elite class was also cultivated to champion these changes. The fourth phase, known as the phase of economic dependence, saw Muslim economies bound to Western systems. Raw materials were extracted from Muslim lands, processed in the West, and then sold back to those same Muslim countries. This system ensured economic dependency. Failure to comply with this arrangement meant economic stagnation or collapse. The ultimate goal was to bind the economies of all Muslim nations to Western control, maintaining a perpetual cycle of dependency.
Marka la isku soo duubo nidaamka ay hay'adaha IMF iyo bangiga adduunka ku shaqeeyaan.
In summary, the system followed by international institutions like the IMF and the World Bank is designed to exploit nations and take advantage of their vulnerabilities. It is based on usury and predatory practices. No African country today benefits from the financial policies and programs set by these organizations. The oppression and injustice they bring to the world is compounded by their war against Islamic law and the financial system ordained by Allah. We should never expect non-believers to bring anything beneficial to Somalia, as their actions only lead to setbacks and poverty. Therefore, those who believe that the IMF and the World Bank will bring prosperity, growth, and progress to Somalia are people who do not fully understand the teachings of the Quran. They are people who fail to grasp the true nature of the non-believers and the clear warnings that Allah the Almighty has given us about them, which is that they are bloodthirsty oppressors. We must not be deceived by the lies they spread to mislead the Muslim community, such as the promises of debt relief, economic growth, and the fight against poverty. Allah the Exalted has made it clear that these claims have no basis. He the Almighty says in the Quran,
يُرْضُونَكُمْ بِأَفْوَاهِهِمْ وَتَأْبَى قُلُوبُهُمْ وَأَكْثَرُهُمْ فَاسِقُونَ.
Since the 1980s, one of the primary methods the IMF and the World Bank used to exploit developing countries was through the strategic use of loans. Whenever a country faced an economic crisis, these institutions presented themselves as benevolent helpers. In reality, however, they were advancing the self-serving interests of Western donor nations. Before granting a loan, the IMF and the World Bank required borrowing countries to implement structural adjustment programs, or SAPs, a set of economic policies imposed as conditions for receiving financial assistance. These programs were typically predatory in nature and dictated the nation's economic policy, demanding measures such as cutting government spending on social services like health and education, privatizing state-owned enterprises, raising taxes, increasing the cost of public services, liberalizing local markets, and devaluing the local currency. The true purpose of these policies was to undermine a country's economic sovereignty, create pathways for multinational companies to extract its resources, and foster an environment that favored the economic interests of Western nations over the needs of the local population. As a result, they often deepened economic hardships and increased the country's dependence on foreign powers rather than enhance development.
The IMF and the World Bank gave a set of loans, particularly in the 80s, that were called structural adjustment. The problem with them was that there were very strong conditions imposed. Countries were told to get this money, they often had to cut out education or health or other expenditures that were really quite vital, enormous cost to many of the developing countries. I think the reason was basically ideological. And there were, of course, some interests that there was money to be made in the process of privatization. When you privatize, you can sometimes raise the price, generate enormous amount of profits. And so there were a few companies that saw the profit opportunity, pushed the IMF, the World Bank, to push these privatization initiatives.
So the International Monetary Fund has, over the past several decades, been pressing very hard the so-called neoliberal programs, which have been a social and economic disaster almost everywhere. So take, say, Egypt, which is right on the front pages. Part of the source of the uprising in Egypt went on for a long time, but peaking is because of the disastrous effects of IMF structural adjustment programs, which have increased growth, but kind of the way they do here, with wealth going into very few pockets and most of the population suffering. And that's been true in place after place. You know,
if the IMF were just concerned about better mechanisms for clearing checks, there would be no controversy. But that's not what the IMF is involved in. It's involved in dictating economic policies that have enormous impacts on countries around the world and the developing countries around the world. And yet, only a limited number of voices are heard. And that is, in some sense, the fundamental problem with the international economic institutions.
The implementation of IMF structural adjustment programs have had devastating effects on populations in developing countries. The mandated reduction in government spending often left critical services, such as healthcare, severely underfunded, making basic necessities like medication prohibitively expensive for many people. Trade liberalization, another key component of these programs, opened the floodgates to cheap imported goods and greatly undermined domestic production. This impact is especially noticeable in developing countries, where the majority of the populations are dependent on farming. Competition from cheap imports that flood the local markets after trade liberalization puts these farmers out of business. Farmers find themselves in a situation where they cannot obtain fair prices for their produce because their products cannot compete with the cheaper, heavily subsidized, and mass-produced foreign goods. Consequently, domestic food production is put at risk, and the agricultural sector is placed in jeopardy, leading to the decline of the local economy. Currency devaluation, on the other hand, made exports cheaper for foreign buyers, but had a harsh impact on local populations. When the value of the local currency dropped, it meant that people could afford less with their earnings. This made life harder for them because basic necessities such as food, fuel, and medicine became more expensive, especially if they were imported.
Toute une série de politiques qui sont appliquées dans les pays du Sud endettés sont dictées à partir de Washington, du siège de la Banque mondiale, du Fonds monétaire international.
Many policies which are forced upon indebted countries in the South are dictated from Washington by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. These countries must also submit to rules created by the World Trade Organization based in Geneva. The World Bank and the IMF demand a raise in taxes, paid mainly by the poor. They demand that the poor pay to receive an education and to receive health care. This leads to the privatization of the health and the education system. The result is that in many African countries, someone arrives at a hospital in need of urgent care and stays long in a waiting room until the family raises enough money for proper treatment. This leads to one out of three people dying without having been treated.
La salle d'opération et la personne, une fois sur trois ou une fois sur quatre, décède sans avoir reçu aucun aucun soin.
One of the tragedies of Africa is that we have very little regard for history. In fact, now it has been cancelled in our schools. Where were we 40 years ago, 50 years ago? We copy a bit too quickly and too wrongly from elsewhere. And we also copy from the wrong sources.
Mm-hmm.
In 1986, we had this thing called the Structural Adjustment Program dumped on Africa.
That destroyed most countries in Africa.
Everything. I was in Hong Kong visiting with a friend when we heard on television that the auctioning began in April.
Auctioning of our national currency.
Exactly. And it was $3 to $1.
1986.
Yes. And economists in Nigeria said it was the only way out. Now, economics is honestly 90% common sense. Why are you auctioning your currency when what to do is to cut down on imports
and boost and
stimulate
export.
Local production? Why are you shipping in rice? That one began as far back as 1982, a task force on the importation of rice. I was a young man in the cabinet. I was 34 years old. And I asked the question, why not a task force for the production of rice? I was told, oh, you guys from the university, you don't know anything. In the interim, let's just import. The bill rose to $5 million a day and remained so for nearly 30 years. You just ship your money out and shipping goods. And once the structural adjustment came, we added onto it free trade. So we opened our windows, our doors, our roofs, and any foreign good was arriving.
Dumped in.
Plastics that wouldn't last an hour in the hand of a child as toys, honey, sugar, milk, toothpicks, handkerchiefs, pins on the table. We produce nothing. If you go to your house and look around,
practically everything.
What is it that is made here? Almost nothing.
One of the most devastating outcomes of IMF and World Bank policies has been how they have shackled developing nations in an endless cycle of dependency. Rather than advancing their own economies, countries in Africa and the developing world have been reduced to mere suppliers of raw materials for the prosperity of Western powers. During the colonial era, imperial powers like Britain, France, and Germany brazenly used violence to strip weaker nations of their resources, funneling wealth into the colonial capitals of London, Paris, and Berlin. After 1960, however, when many African countries presumably gained their independence, the World Bank and IMF seamlessly stepped into this role, ensuring the continued flow of resources from poor countries to rich ones. The only difference was that instead of using military force, the IMF and World Bank used debt policies to maintain the same level of exploitation under a more acceptable guise.
Africa historically, sub-Saharan Africa, has been fundamental to the global prosperity of the advanced countries, okay? And Africa had a role to play. It has a role as a raw material producer. We will not allow sub-Saharan Africa to escape that, okay? We do everything to keep sub-Saharan Africa where it is, also impoverished. It's absolutely vital for the prosperity of everyone. So let's get clear about that. Okay, and this means all the economic structures, all the global institutions, and the economics we teach everyone is all designed to keep Africa exactly where it is. And whether it is Europe or US or now China, it's always the same. We need Africa to be impoverished because we need those raw materials and we need them dirt cheap. It's economic warfare. The rich declare war on the poor. It happens everywhere. It happens in a country. The rich control the government. Of course they do. You really believe you have democracy? Come on. Go on. This is not about people living in democratic systems. What we have is the rich control. The rich set up these institutions explicitly to control the poor countries. And they don't give them much room for maneuver. But what do these institutions do? What does the IMF do? What is structural adjustment about? It's about making sure countries keep producing what we want them to produce.
As a result of IMF-driven policies, African countries rich in minerals and resources often fail to enjoy the benefits of their own wealth. Instead, These resources are extracted at very low prices and shipped to Western countries, where they are processed, refined, and sold for profit. This means that African nations miss out on the true value of their raw materials.
Dear brothers, I want to tell you that today Somalia has the potential to become one of the most developed countries in the world economically, but it is not allowed to do so. Somalia has 5 million hectares of arable land. Somalia also has oil in both the land and sea, which is no less than what is found in the Middle East. Studies have shown that Somalia's oil reserves are over 100 billion barrels. Last year, the company Coastline Exploration estimated that Somalia could produce up to 100,000 barrels of oil per day. In 2015, a study by the USGS Mineral Survey revealed that Somalia has vast mineral deposits, including bauxite, copper, feldspar, gold, iron, limestone, natural gas, silica, tin, and uranium. In 1960, UN researchers reported that Somalia's uranium reserves could reach 800,000 tons, which is the largest single deposit of uranium found anywhere in the world. Somalia also has the longest coastline in Africa. It is estimated that Somalia can produce up to 835,000 tons of fish annually. Therefore, given that Somalia has all these resources and blessings, why is it still poor? This is due to the global system set by the disbelievers, which do not allow Somalia to benefit from its resources. And this is the main problem that many African countries face.
By 2020, after half a century of World Bank and IMF policies, the economic makeup of many African countries told a clear story. In Niger, uranium accounted for 75% of the country's national export proceeds. Mali relied on gold for 72% of its exports, while Zambia relied on copper for 70% of its exports. Burundi's economy was driven by 69% coffee, Malawi's by 55% tobacco, and Togo's by 50% cotton. These resources were not mined or produced to improve the lives of the local population, but rather to fuel French nuclear plants, supply Chinese electronics, stock German supermarkets, produce British cigarettes, and clothe American consumers. In other words, both the resources and labor forces of these African nations were channeled into sustaining Western economies, who benefited from the low-cost extraction of raw materials, while leaving African countries unable to leverage their wealth to improve their own standards of living.
Africa producing raw materials, matière première, they call it in Francais, matière première, raw materials. Our iron ore is the purest in the world. It is 70% pure. An Indian wanted to take that iron ore to India, imagine. Iron ore in Runyankore, in our language, is called obtare, but it is soil, black soil. If you see it, it is soil. To take that to India and do what? Pay your wonderful people $47 per ton. Our iron ore is the purest in the world. It is 70% pure. So you need like 1.5 tons to make a ton of steel. Now, a ton of steel costs $700. Somebody gives you $47 on your wealth, the wealth of your people, and he gets $700 from it. And all the jobs, your children have no jobs. Watoto wa Hindi wanafanya wanapata kazi. I can't be part of that treachery. So I banned, there will be no export of unprocessed minerals from Uganda. So there's no business. What do you mean there's no business? So when I banned them, they are flocking in now. They have opened 7 gold refineries. 7 gold refineries, they are there. Because I banned.
We have become consumers of what we do not produce and producers of what we do not consume. Africa still is famous for producing primary goods with very little or minimum value addition. When you are in that business where you are a farmer of rubber in Liberia and the raw rubber is taken to Europe for Michelin to make tires or Firestone to make tires, you cannot realize your potential. When you are a farmer of cocoa in Togo, La Côte d'Ivoire, or in Ghana, and you do not make chocolate, I know there are now attempts to make chocolate, but you take it to Cadbury in the United Kingdom or to Nestle in Switzerland, then you buy chocolate at 20 times what your cocoa was worth, then you cannot grow. When you have lithium in the Democratic Republic of Congo and in Zimbabwe and you do not make batteries, then you take it to Europe and America. When you have coltan and no African country apart from assembling mobile phones are all importing mobile phones, then you cannot. If you have coffee and you do not have value addition, it's Nestle that does. If you have milk and it's Lato that is doing it, and even today in Africa, almost all the major water bottling companies have been bought by Coca-Cola or Nestle. That is the state in which Africa finds itself.
Another major factor contributing to the depletion of resources in developing countries was the IMF and World Bank's push to open up markets, which allowed foreign multinational corporations to seize control of key industries and natural resources. While these corporations reaped enormous profits from exporting the resources, the local populations saw little benefit. Many people were often forced off their lands without fair compensation, and those employed by these corporations received very low wages, deepening the cycle of poverty and inequality. Most of the profits were sent abroad rather than being reinvested locally to benefit the population at home. In Ghana, for instance, foreign companies mined $5.2 billion worth of gold between 1990 and 2002, but the government received only $87.3 million. In other words, a staggering 98.4% of the profits from gold mined in Ghanaian soil went to foreign companies. Similarly, in Mauritania's Mafema mining project, run by French companies, 72% of the income was sent overseas in 1969. Another example of this resource drain is the Dominion Group of companies operating in Kenya. Originally founded in 2002 by American investor Calvin Burgess, Dominion Farms aimed to develop a large-scale agricultural project in the country. However, the local population has gained very little from the investment.
Now, come the year 2003, they told us that government is coming to invest here. Instead of seeing government, we saw a very unique company. This is a company from USA, Edmond, Oklahoma, USA. The company is called Dominion Group of Companies. This company is investing here, is in collaboration with Kenya government to invest here. And it's quite unfortunate that what he produces there, the little that he produces there, are not sold to us. They are ferried to America. They are taken back to America. So we, the local people, the land is ours. We gain nothing from that land. It is the American government gaining, and maybe some corrupt government officials. So we are now subjected to a life of servitude in our own ancestry.
Well, I think there's been an enormous interest in Africa since about the 1980s. With the introduction of the neoliberal policies of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, what we have is essentially occupied territories. Territories occupied by the large corporations and supported by the international financial institutions and the aid agencies. And so what they are there to do is to reap as much benefits as they can, avoid as much tax as they can, and profiteer. And the price that is paid by most Africans is massive dispossession of their land, massive unemployment, massive decline in standard of living, and more hungry people than there ever were. That's the situation which Africa currently face. Now, clearly, there are competitions between the different international powers for Africa's natural resources. What is missing out of that element is the voice of the African citizens about what they need. It's all very well having investments in Africa, but if the country or the people of the country don't benefit from it, then it's no good to anyone. The reality of the last 30 years in Africa has been that increasingly our governments are more accountable to the international financial institutions, the DFIDs, the BFIDs, the Danidas, Bonitas, Canitas of the world, and they are more accountable to the international agencies than they are to citizens. And I think, you know, it's all very well saying there's been huge growth rates, but who is benefiting from those growth rates? In fact, the division between the rich and the poor has actually increased dramatically over the last 30 years. And as for the World Bank and their apologists who talk about, you know, the middle class is beginning with $2 a day, a pound a day? Have you tried living in Nairobi on a pound a day? These guys, if they think this is the middle classes, they must be on some other planet, I'm afraid.
In addition to the plundering of minerals and resources, the policies imposed by IMF and the World Bank have also undermined food security in developing countries. Despite Africa holding 65% of the world's uncultivated arable land, an abundant supply of fresh water, and nearly 300 days of sunshine each year, it still remains the poorest continent on Earth. Rather than producing its own food, Africa spends $35 billion annually on food imports, a figure expected to rise to $110 billion by 2025. This dependency is no accident. It's the carefully calculated outcome of policies that ensure developing countries always remain reliant on external sources for their basic needs. It's a system that keeps developing countries completely trapped in a never-ending cycle of dependence on wealthier, more advanced nations. Favoring political gain over local economic interests, weak and often corrupt African leaders perpetuate this vicious cycle of dependency by willingly complying with the demands of international financial institutions instead of pushing for self-sufficiency.
And they've also done something very, very important. And that is they have destroyed the self-sufficiency of these countries. Colonization started it. Okay? One of the most important things is we destroy food self-sufficiency. Okay? And the World Bank continued it. They forced most countries to eliminate all food subsidies and food support. Okay? Because once you don't produce your own food, I increase my control of it. How do we know this? Well, very funny thing happened some years ago. Not so funny, actually. It involved starvation of a large number of people in Malawi. Okay? Many of you could remember this because it was really tragic. But the Malawian finance minister, who was under terrible threat at the time, suddenly broke ranks and he said, well, you know why we had this famine? Because one of the conditions of the loan given by the World Bank was we destroyed all our grain surplus stocks. Why? Because remember, we want you dependent. 1970s, the US Senate, the US Congress said, we will not allow Latin America to produce their own food. We will start a strategy involving the IMF and the World Bank to destroy food self-sufficiency of Latin America. Then they will indeed be our true backyard. And that's exactly what they've done. Look at all the Latin American countries. Look at them. They used to be food self-sufficient, but they're no longer food self-sufficient.
The principle underlying the foundation of the World Bank, the International Bank for IBRD, research, the World Bank, is that no country should grow its own food. Africa and the Third World should only grow export crops. To export, in order to have an oversupply of cocoa and other tropical raw materials, to keep down the price, they must buy their grain from the United States or Europe, so that if they do something that we don't like, we can do what America tried to do to China in the 60s. We can sanction them. We can say, we're going to starve you. We're going to not export any grain to you. So owing their foreign debt in dollars means that they have to somehow sell something that the United States wants, not what they want. I think the most evil organizations in the world today are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. I think the most evil organizations in the world today are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund.
This has been the devastating legacy of IMF and World Bank policies in the developing world. Driven by greed, exploitation, and self-interest, these neoliberal policies have not only led to economic devastation, but they have destroyed millions of lives and deepened poverty in the very countries they claimed to assist.
I mean, we're talking tens of millions of people were killed by these policies. And no one, I don't think Larry Summers will ever go to prison for this. In fact, no one even knows that he was involved in this. He was chief architect of the economic wing of the World Bank in the early 90s. And he went to the White House, and now he's like telling us what to do on Twitter. Like he's living in a mansion. Like he's not going to go to prison for this. None of these people will ever go to prison for structural adjustment that they perpetrated on the global South. So I don't think we're ever going to get justice.
Entire nations have been trapped in cycles of debt, dependency, and underdevelopment, with little hope of escaping. By every possible measure, these policies represent a dangerous and destructive form of economic warfare, driven by greed and the self-serving interests of wealthy Western powers. What makes this particularly insidious is that the policies are often presented as pathways to development, but in reality, they only serve to deepen inequality and maintain economic dominance. The damage inflicted by these policies is comparable, in the words of one leading American economist, to bombs dropped from 50,000 feet, where the pilot never sees or feels the destruction on the ground. In the same way, the bankers and economists responsible for imposing these harmful policies on poor nations operate from the comfort of their luxury hotel rooms and are blind to the lives they ruin. In the end, countries that implemented IMF policies suffered twice. First, through the burden of heavy debts, and then through the devastating effects of the structural adjustment programs imposed upon them. These programs created an environment that left poor nations beholden to the lender countries. The truth is that these institutions have made millions of people in many developing countries poorer and more vulnerable, while enriching dictators and corrupt leaders. They have prioritized the flow of food, resources, and cheap labor from poor countries to wealthy ones, while turning a blind eye to the so-called human rights they frequently claim to defend. This isn't a mistake or an exception. It's how the IMF and the World Bank operate, disguising exploitation as development.
The IMF and World Bank, if they're supposed to benefit poor people, I mean, they often have this thing draped on their headquarters in DC that says end poverty. And then you start to realize that's not what they're doing. They're not creating loans for these countries to benefit people there. They're doing it to benefit us. Those benefits come in three ways that we as Americans, let's say, benefit from, from institutions like the IMF and World Bank and other kinds of lending to the what we would call, whatever you want to say, the third world, global south, developing countries, emerging markets. Basically, there's a billion people in our world and then everybody else, 6.7 or so billion elsewhere. The first one is interest. And this is something that I didn't even really think about too deeply. Like, I don't even know. Like, when you're just thinking about the IMF and World Bank, maybe you think they're charity. No, they're like lenders, predatory lenders, basically. They charge very high interest rates. So again, the three things that we got out of the IMF and World Bank over the last 50, 60 years were interest payments, cheap labor and resources, and political control. I mean, some of the political control stuff is so shocking. I'm going to show a slide from the New York Times from 1978 tomorrow from Zaire, what was then Zaire. And it was very plain. The headline just said, Zaire takes like large loan from IMF and gives up economic control of its country. So basically the IMF staffed the treasury ministry of this country with its own people. Like we basically would take over these countries. It's completely wild. Like we basically would take over these countries. It's completely wild.
But the suffering doesn't end there. Once a country becomes entrenched in debt, the IMF reappears, offering a new set of programs under the guise of debt relief. In the next episode, we will take a closer look at the IMF's so-called debt relief program and uncover the truth behind this seemingly benevolent initiative. Is it truly an altruistic gesture aimed at helping struggling nations? Or is it merely a continuation of the cycle of dependency? Is it meant to help developing nations? Or is it just merely a way to reinforce the existing structures of economic control imposed by the global financial institutions? Join us in the next episode as we explore how this deceptive approach continues to trap nations in cycles of debt and dependency.